In part 9 of our series, The Fruit of the Spirit, the final topic is self-control. The need for self-control should be obvious, but self-control is something secular man scorns. So how should the Christian deal with worldliness? And how does that affect our values, sin nature, and heart? Here's Pastor Seth.
We are finishing our series on the fruit of the Spirit. There was a seminary student who his preaching professor had encouraged his whole class to go to this public speaking forum that was going to be done on the weekend. And so this young kid, 22 years old, had never done a sermon. You know, he decides he needs to go and learn, you know, about public speaking. So he's sitting there, and the first guy, nationally known guy, comes out to do the sermon or to do the message. And he's sitting there, and the fella comes out, and he gets his mic on, and he says, he starts off this way. I spent the best years of my life in the arms of a woman who is not my wife. And everybody went, oh. And there was a dramatic pause for about 5 seconds, and the speaker said, it was my mother. And everybody laughed, oh, that's great, you know, kind of a funny joke. And he was illustrating, you know, getting, sort of capturing your attention when you're giving a talk. And so, well, the next, on Sunday, our seminary student was supposed to do his first sermon ever at a church out in the country. And he was petrified. I remember doing my first one, and after my first sermon that I gave, the pastor of the church on the following week handed me a book on theology. So this kid decided that, hey, what a great attention getter. So he was going to use the same attention getter that he had just heard from this nationally known speaker. And so the kid gets up there and he forgot his notes. And he's trying to remember how the story went. And he's sort of panicking and he gets up in front of these about 30 folks and he says, I spent the best years of my life in the arms of a woman who was not my wife. And then these people at church are kind of, and then he's waiting for the dramatic pause and he forgets the punchline. 5 seconds pass, 6 seconds, 7 seconds, 8 seconds, 9 seconds, 10 seconds, and now it's really awkward. And the kid just blurts out, and for the life of me, I can't remember who she is. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. I have to tell you that in writing this message this week, I was sort of reminded. I kept thinking I would have written a very different message about 10 years ago. But our culture has changed so much in the last 10 years that I found myself rewriting this several times and finally trying to talk about this in a way that intersects with where we live out there in the real world. When I think about the need for self-control, it used to be that self-control, it was sort of evident, self-evident, that of course you need that. But I realize, you know, in listening to the news and watching movies and books and hearing people talk out in the real world, that's not so self-evident anymore. In fact, what's becoming more self-evident is that self-control is something that is more and more scorned at, scoffed at, sneered at. And what's happened is something like the free expression to be who you are and how you feel and what your desires are becomes so much so that self-control becomes almost an enemy towards my identity and my self-fulfillment. Now, that kind of thinking may sound good on the college campus when you're 19 or 20 years old. But after you've been out in the real world a few years, you realize that self-control is not just a nice thing to add on to your life. But it can keep you out of things like having to go to AA meetings or sexual addiction meetings or divorce recovery groups It can keep you out of sometimes therapist's office or counselor's offices. It can keep you sometimes out of court or custody hearings or bankruptcy attorneys. Sometimes it can keep you from tear-stained pillows and sleepless nights. When my brother and I were young, my mother and father used to talk to us about playing with fire. And I think that my brother and I sort of heard that little phrase, playing with fire, with the emphasis on the first two words, playing with. We were sort of fascinated by fire. But my dad said, you know, this is, you are not to do this. But my brother one day was out in the garage. This is when he lived in Colorado. And he had the garage door up, and he had some newspapers out there. And he had some matches. He was about fourth grade, I think, third grade. And he had a gallon of gas that my dad used for the mower. And he sort of, you know, he'd lit some of the papers and, you know, he just kind of gotten in this, and my mother came walking out to get something in the garage and, of course, was mortified. Suddenly, we realized that the term walking with fire, playing with fire, the most important word in that phrase was the last word. My mother lit into my little brother, and when my father came home, he decided to teach my brother a lesson. And my father, being a wise father, also decided to include me as a witness, because I also probably needed some help in this direction, which I did. So my father went into my younger brother's bedroom and pulled out five or six of his favorite toys and things he loved. And we walked outside the back, and back then in Colorado you had what was called an incinerator. Tells you that I'm not 43 years old. About this high, and you could burn trash in there or whatever. And so my dad had my brother start a fire in the incinerator. And then once that thing got going, he had my brother, one at a time, put these things into the incinerator and watch them burn. I watched this as this happened. And I can tell you that from then on, my brother and I were not interested in playing with fire anymore. Because suddenly the last word in that little phrase had meaning. When we're talking about saying no or controlling your desires, this is not a matter of, oh, isn't this so sweet? Wouldn't this be so much fun? It can't be that harmful. We're talking about a matter of you are playing with fire that is in your lap. And it may not just burn you, but it may burn the lives of some people that you are close to. When I think about this, I think that most of the time, 10 years ago, I would have written a message on of the three enemies that we face, the world, the flesh, and the devil. I would have sort of de-emphasized the world and focused more on my desires, wrong desires, and then Satan, how Satan works. But I was really struck that the world has changed so much in the last 10 years. And when we think of the enemies that would take us down and destroy us, where we could destroy ourselves by following our desires, the world really operates at two different levels. It operates one level by, in the short term, right in front of you, what is in front of you that the world has to offer that it's tempting you with to go ahead and take or to bite on. But in another sense, the world, as the Bible uses this, or worldliness, is sort of the perspective and values that the world is throwing your way that helps to validate, not really validate, but towards our heart, our desires and what Satan throws our way. So I want to take a little bit of time just to, what strikes me about our current culture, and this is in your handout, the secular worldview, as I see it, and this is going to take in about 2 minutes. So there's way more than this, but I just want to put these things in front of you. The triumph of relativism. There are no absolutes. What's true for you is true for you, and what's true for me is true for me. Don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me what the Bible, there's some authority. I'm going to do what's right for me. This is what's out there in our culture. The God of the secular world is tolerance. This is the one at which all those who are not politically correct are being forced to bow down to. The high priestess in this is feelings. Feelings are what's important. That's the triumph. I want to feel good. I want to feel good now. I want to feel good by ways that make sense to me. I want to feel fulfilled in my marriage and as a parent and in my life, how I determine that to be. Feelings have become huge. A barometer of what's right. The new victimhood is being offended. There's a college campus that has picked up the mantra, if one is offended, we're all offended. Really? We're going to spend a lot of time being offended. I hope I'm on a campus of three students, if that's the mantra. I'll be one angry fella. The new sin is disagreement. How dare you disagree with what everybody else believes is true? Debate has been replaced with outrage. The high priest is desires. And the ultimate goal is freedom, defined by, I want to be free to live the life how I want to live, by what I think, what I value, and what makes me feel the way I want to. My question is that freedom? Now, most of you know my testimony, and when I went off to college, I was free in that sense to do what I wanted to do. And after about 2.5 years of that, I found myself moving from freedom towards bondage, towards slavery, towards emptiness, and a sense of loneliness, even though I had tons of friends in my life. What is freedom? Freedom is something very different from being free to do what I want to make me feel a certain way. In your handout, freedom is not the desire to do what I want. Freedom is the power to do what I ought. We just sang a couple great songs this morning about freedom. Freedom to do what I ought. Freedom from my own selfish nature, my own sin nature, which would take me down and take others with me. In Hebrews 11, the writer describes Moses chose to be mistreated along with the people of God, rather than enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. And he adds, for a short time. This is the aftermath of following our feelings and desires that are unbridled. In the short term, it feels great. This is awesome. This is what I've lived for. This is who I am. But what's coming in the aftermath, it's going to bite. That's how sin, the nature of sin is. Galatians 5:13. Paul says, you, my brothers, are called to freedom. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh. The flesh in the New Testament means for your unbridled passions, negative sinful desires. Don't use your freedom for that. Instead, serve one another in love. Now, what he's talking about is that's the biblical definition of freedom. Free to be the person, not that I want to be or I feel to be, but who God made me to be. And free to love God and to love the people in my life well without that awful sin that I carry around with me wherever I go. And to reflect the wonder of who God is in my relationships. Okay, that's just all kind of by way of introduction. All right, let's dive into three enemies, the world, the flesh, and the devil. Self-control, I need self-control in dealing with the world. Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, love for the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. The idea here is, and it's important, is what you love the most matters. What you love the most matters. It has an effect. A ripple effect through your relationships, through your responsibilities, and into your personal life. When I think about what one of the things my mentor has said, is he said, it's not that Christians don't love God. We all love God as Christians. The problem is there are other things we love more than God. That's what John is talking about here in this verse. Matthew 22, Jesus said, you shall love the Lord your God. But how? With all your heart, all your mind, all your strength. This is the first and great commandment. A second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. Now, why does God insist upon us loving him at the top of that totem pole? Because whenever we love something lesser, of lesser value than him, we become lesser as people. It has an effect on us. We call these things like loneliness or emptiness or anxiety or fear or anger or irritated. There's something about becoming a lesser person that's hard to see about you. It's hard to see about me. But it's if you're a parent and you have a 27-year-old son who's living at home and he spends all day playing video games, you have something of the picture here of what Jesus is saying and John is saying, why we love God more than anything else. I can love something as like a video game. Nothing wrong with playing video games. But if I'm playing video games 8 hours a day, there's something happening to me. I'm not becoming the person, the man that God designed me to be. I'm becoming lesser than what I should be. This is what the world is after. Now, I may feel like at the moment when I'm playing video games that this is what I was made for. This is where I excel. This is where I feel important. In the moment, that may be true. Or maybe for 8 hours, that still may be true. But there's coming a day when that's no longer going to be true. And you're going to wonder, what am I missing out in life on? Self-control is also needed in dealing with our passions, what the New Testament calls our flesh. Proverbs says there is a way that seems right to a man, but in the end it leads to death. In our current culture, it would read something more like this. There is a way that feels right to a man, but in the end it leads to death. Now, there are lots of different kinds of passions, lots of different kinds of desires. When the Bible uses the word desires and passions, it's not using them as if they're all the same thing. Kind of like going to Baskin and Robbins and picking among 31 flavors. Not like that. There are some desires that are legitimate and good, and there are others that are killers. Let's look at some examples of the types of desires that the New Testament tells about. 1 Thessalonians 4:5. Not in passionate lust like the heathen who do not know God. Here, generally in our culture, what passes for love oftentimes is driven by what the New Testament calls the lust to have, the lust to possess, the lust to feel good by using you. That is not a good desire. 1 Peter 2:11, dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world to abstain from sinful desires. Now, why do we abstain from sinful desires? Well, we abstain from sinful desires because they're wrong and because God tells us to. But even if those two reasons don't make sense to you, perhaps the reason he cites here should. Because they wage war against your soul. There is some autoimmune disease where it attacks, your autoimmune system attacks your vital organs. Lupus. Your own system that's supposed to be fighting off infection is now attacking you. That's a picture of what, if we follow our sinful desires, we are doing something to ourselves, to who we are as people. In our, most of the time when I think about this, I think about our identity. As Christians, our identity is rooted in several really important things. We are a creature made by a creator, which tells us we are important. Secondly, we are made in the Creator's image, which also tells us we are important. Third, when we were created, we were gendered, not just physiologically, but we were gendered in our soul, in our heart, in our essence of who we are as a person. We are male, or you are made female, through and through. Now, whether you decide to live that way or not is up to you. But these are irrevocable givens in every human being. Now, as Christians, our identity is further anchored by the cross, which tells us I matter to God, and in spite of my rebellion and my self-centeredness and my tendency to run away as a prodigal son, that God will keep coming after me because he loves me, and Jesus Christ died for me. Both he and the Son, Father and Son, love me enough for me to be in their family. I am home. Now, those things are supposed to anchor me as a person, to anchor me in such a way that as I enter my life, I am free to reflect the wonder of how I am loved to the people in my life, and free to engage with the problems and responsibilities and trials that are in front of me. Apart from that, if I am living to try to fill something, I'm going to inevitably become like what Peter describes here, is I'm going to be living to fill desires that are going to only come and make me worse. Ephesians 4:22, you were taught with regard to your former way of life to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by deceitful desires. Another adjective here, and this adjective should alert us that there are some desires that feel right, and they feel so good, and what could be so wrong with this? And though we may not see it or sense it or understand it yet, what he says here is some of these desires, there's a snake in the grass. And if you play with this, you are going to get bit by that snake. You are not playing with cotton candy. You are playing with a rattlesnake. Be careful. Romans 1:26 talks about a different kind of passion. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. Dishonorable passions. Meaning there are some passions that seem like they should work and they should be legitimate and what could be wrong with them. But given living out of those passions over a length of time, they're going to bring dishonor, what we call shame or regret. Different kinds of desires, the world, the flesh, and then Satan. In Acts 26, when Jesus Christ meets Saul, who's about to become the Apostle Paul, part of his conversion experience is his call to ministry. And listen to what Jesus includes in this call to ministry. Verse 18. I'm going to use you to open their eyes that they may turn from darkness to light, from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and a place among those who are sanctified by faith in me. Ephesians 2:2. He's writing a letter to the Ephesians. He's reminding them in verses 1 through 3 of chapter 2 about what their life used to be, in which you used to live when you followed, notice, the ways of the world. We talked about that earlier. And followed the ways of the ruler of the kingdom of the air. Here he's talking about Satan. The spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient. Verse 3. All of us also lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our sinful nature. Now he's referring back to our passions and desires that wage war against our soul, as Peter said. We follow its desires and thoughts like the rest. We were by nature objects of wrath. When we have deceitful feelings that come our way and passions and desires that come our way, whether they be from the world or out of our own hearts, Satan is there sort of adding a little bit of breeze to this little smoldering wick that wants to become a fire. Hoping that it will ignite and the little kindling will catch on and you will become seduced by this particular fire. Instead of these kinds of desires being something to think about and coddle and wonder, these are something from which to run. like what my brother should have done in the garage back in Colorado. 1 Peter 5:8 says, be self-controlled. Be self-controlled. And alert. Alert to what? Satan. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to have a snack on. You're not happy with a snack. Devour is the word. To eat you up, spit you out, destroy everything that's important to you, including you and the people that you love. Now, self-control. Let's look at two last things here. How does it protect us? And what are we risking when we say no to it, don't see our need for it? Jesus says, watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the body is weak. If you wonder, well, I just seem to be so weak and my desires seem to be so strong. Duh! That's not a big surprise. Should not be a big surprise to you. If it is, go back and read most of the verses from today's message. Therefore, prepare your minds for action, Peter says. Be self-controlled. Set your hope fully on the grace to be given you when Jesus Christ is revealed. You can expect to be in a war with what the world says to you, a war with your desires that rise up with you, and a war with Satan. Romans 6, let not sin therefore reign in your mortal bodies to make you obey their passions. Now you know what our secular world calls, it summarizes that verse in one word. Addiction. Let not sin therefore reign, be the ruler, the king, in your mortal bodies to make you obey their passions. You and I give in long enough, certain passions and desires, and over time, somebody else is in charge. This is what led me to Christ my junior year in college. Do not yield your members to sin as instruments of wickedness, but yield yourselves to God as men who have been brought from death to life, your members to God as instruments of righteousness. Instead of yielding to my desires and temptations, I am yielding to God. Colossians 3:5 says, put to death. Not toy with, not enjoy, not dabble with, not make a couple little easy changes here, maybe it'll get better. It says, take out your sword. You're dealing with a snake. Take out the axe and chop that head off. You may need to do this every day. If you do, join the club. Put to death what is earthly in you. Fornication, impurity, in other words, sex outside of marriage in whatever form that happens to take. Passion, evil desire, and covetousness. You are not playing with bunny rabbits. You're playing with snakes. Proverbs 6:24. Here in the end of Proverbs 5, 6, and 7, Solomon gives advice to his son about getting involved with women that he had no business getting involved with. He says, to preserve you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adventuress, do not desire her beauty in your heart. Do not let her capture you with her eyelashes. Now, it's interesting to me that the instruction is not, when you're standing in the hotel lobby about to check in with somebody you shouldn't be checking into, run away. Now, you should run away if that's the situation you're in. But what Solomon wisely sees is this battle starts way before you get to the hotel lobby or way before you get to somebody's house. You have no business being at their house. This battle starts even when this person is not even in your presence. Do not let her beauty captivate you in your heart. Do not let her capture you with her eyelashes. She doesn't even have to be in your presence for that to happen and to give in to that desire. But little by little, Satan's got you on that fishing line. He is reeling you in. You keep giving in to those things, it'll be a matter of where you're going to find yourself in a hotel room and wondering, how did I get here? You got there by about 1,000 smaller giving in to temptation along the way in ways that probably 950 of them, nobody knew except you. They were so subtle, you may not even know that you gave in the 900 of them. Consequences of self-control, what's it like to be without it? Galatians 6, do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. He who sows to the flesh, or he who sows to please his sinful nature, from that nature will reap destruction. Just because something feels good on the front end, doesn't mean it's going to feel all that great on the back end. The one who sows to please the Spirit, from the Spirit reap eternal life. Romans 7, 18, I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is, in my flesh. Somebody says, well, Seth, do you trust your feelings? I don't trust my feelings at all. My feelings are the last thing I'm going to trust about me. I am very suspect of my feelings. I am very suspect of my desires. There are good desires, but that's usually not the thing that I deal with. I have the desire to do what is right, but not the ability to carry it out. James 1, each one is tempted when by his own evil desires he is dragged away and enticed. After desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. Sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. Do not be deceived. There's a domino process here. From desires down to actions. Jesus said in Matthew 16, if any man would come after me, we're going to follow Christ. Let him deny himself. That is an anathema in the secular world and on the college campus. I don't want to deny myself. I want to fulfill myself. Good luck with that. Take up his cross and follow me. Whoever would save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world, fulfills all of his desires on the front end, and forfeits his life? Think this through, Jesus says. What shall a man give in return for his life? In the late 1800s, there was a forestry group of lumberjacks, forestry guys, up at the top of a mountain in the Pacific Northwest. They were working the top of the mountain, and in order to get the logs down to the bottom of the mountain, they build a sluice, and they would take the logs to the beginning of that sluice and let gravity just haul these thousands of pounds of logs down the mountain at breakneck speed down to the end of the valley, where they could then put them into the river to get them downstream to the mill. At the end of the day, there would be some kind of alert. I think a gun went off, and what that said was that all the logs that are going down the sluice for today, we're all done with that. And so what the men liked to do was then to get on the sluice, kind of like a slide, and slide down to the bottom of the mountain rather than walk all the way down. Now, one particular fella thought he heard the alert, and he got onto the sluice, and he was on his way down. And on his way down, he got his left arm caught between two of the sideboards. And he's sort of dangling from his left arm, and he's trying to free himself, but he's having a hard time reaching around and with gravity pulling him down, getting up enough leverage to get up to extricate himself. And suddenly he hears a sound and a shudder that makes him filled with horror. The last log had not come down the sluice. There was one more that was making its way down. He could hear the roar of that log coming down, and he could hear or feel the sluice shaking beneath him. And he knew that he had just seconds to go before he would just be squashed. He couldn't extricate himself. He took out his axe, and right above his elbow, chopped off his arm. Let go of the axe, reached up here, and rolled himself up just as that log went down beneath him. This is the world you and I live in. We're not talking about dabbling with sin, having fun. Isn't this cute? Oh, this is the interesting thoughts to think about. These are issues of life and death. It may not be life and death for you today, but it could be life and death for you in months or years from now. Let's pray together. Father, I suspect most of us know our need for self-control. That shouldn't be that great a need to understand that. Left to ourselves, we will do a lot of damage to ourselves and others. We need self-control. We thank you that you love even wayward people like we are. And people sometimes still become prodigals and run away to a far country to try to follow some desire, some need that we think is most important, that we need to fulfill. It's only going to bring us into greater bondage and emptiness. And probably hurt some folks around us as well. Father, would you alert us and allow us to walk as alerted people to what the world is telling us as we live, what the world is offering us as of most importance. Help us to be alert to our own hearts and the desires that would be particularly deceitful desires that promise one thing and can't possibly deliver what they promise. And help us to be alert to what Satan is trying to do to us as well. Help us to hear his whispers. Help us to yield ourselves to you. And where we need to take out an axe in our life, in our heart, or with our words, or in our actions, or in our relationships, help us to be circumspect and wise.
We at Pacific Church of Irvine invite you to join us every Sunday at 9:30. You can also visit our website at pacificchurch.com.